Rule 5. Do not do what you hate. Pathological order in its day-to-day guise. I once had a client who was subject to a barrage of constant idiocy as part of her work in a giant corporation. She was a sensible, honest person who had withstood and managed a difficult life and who genuinely wished to contribute and work in a manner commensurate with her good sense and honesty. She became subject, while employed in the corporate environment, to a long in-person and email-mediated dispute about whether the term flip chart, a common phrase referring to a large pad of paper sheets typically supported by a tripod, was in fact a term of abuse. For those of you who still find it difficult to believe that conversations such as this occupy the hours of corporate workers, try a quick Google search. Flip chart derogatory will suffice. You will see immediately that concern about this issue genuinely and rather widely exists. Many meetings were held by her superiors at work to discuss this issue. Flip was apparently at one time a derogatory term for Filipino. I could find little evidence for its use now. Even though the former slur has nothing whatsoever to do with flip chart, the administrators of her firm felt that their time was well spent discussing the hypothetically prejudicial nature of the phrase and formulating a replacement term, the use of which eventually became mandatory among employees. This was all despite the fact that no employee of Filipino nationality or descent had ever complained about the corporation's use of the term. According to the Global Language Monitor, languagemonitor.com, which monitors but does not approve politically correct word usage, the proper term is now writing block, despite the fact that a flip chart is in no way a block. In any case, the corporation in question settled on easel pad, which seems somewhat more descriptively accurate, not that this comparatively elegant solution detracts from the foolishness in question. After all, we are still left with flip-flopped, flippant, flip-flops, flippers, and so on. And at least the first two of those sound more derogatory on first exposure than flip chart if we're going to concern ourselves with such things. Now, you might wonder, what difference does this minor change in terminology really make? It is a trivial problem. Why would someone become concerned about the fact that such change is being discussed? Why not ignore it, as it is best to ignore so much folly and concentrate on something of more importance? Because, of course, you could claim that paying attention to someone attending to such issues is as much a waste of time as attending to the discussion in the first place. And I would say that is precisely the conundrum Rule 5 is trying to address. When do you stop participating in a worrisome process that you see or think you see unfolding in front of you? My client first wrote me about the fact that not only was the string of communication discussing the use of flip chart well received by her co-workers, but that a contest of sorts immediately emerged to identify and communicate additional words that might also be offensive. Blackboard was mentioned, as was master key, the former perhaps because referring to anything as black, even if it is black, is somehow racist in our hypersensitive times. The latter because of its hypothetical relationship to terminology historically associated with slavery. My client tried to make sense of what she was witnessing. She thought, such discussions give people the superficial sense of being good, noble, compassionate, open-hearted, and wise. So, if anyone disagrees, how could that person join the discussion without being considered anti-compassionate, narrow-minded, racist, and wicked? She was also perturbed because no one at her workplace was apparently bothered that any given group of people might endow themselves with the authority to ban words and to disdain or even discipline those who continued to use them, without perceiving any ethical overreach on their part and without perceiving the danger of such censorship, which could easily extend, say, to personal opinions, topics of conversation, or, for that matter, books. Finally, she believed that the entire discussion constituted a prime example of diversity, inclusivity, and equity, terms that had become veritable mantras for the departments of human resources or learning and development, the latter of which she worked for. She regarded them as, quote, engines of corporate indoctrination and ideological propaganda, end quote, and as part of the manner in which the political correctness that characterizes, above all, many university programs extends its reach into the broader culture. More importantly, however, she asked me in one of her letters, "Is this a case where enough is enough? When and where do we stop? If a tiny minority of people even hypothetically find some words offensive, then what? Do we continue to ban words endlessly?" What my client was perceiving, at least as far as she was concerned, was not a single event, hypothetically capable of heading those involved in it down a dangerous path, but a clearly identifiable and causally related variety or sequence of events, all heading in the same direction. Those events seemed to form a coherent pattern associated with an ideology that was directional in its intent, explicitly and implicitly. Furthermore, the effect of that directionality had been manifesting itself, by all appearances, for a reasonable amount of time, not only in the corporate world my client inhabited, but in the broader world of social and political institutions surrounding the corporation for which she worked. Although rather isolated in the department she happened to work in, the very epicenter of the ideological blitz of the corporation in question, she could see around her evidence that the processes disturbing her were also having a detrimental effect on other people. And then there was the effect on her conscience. It is important to understand that these issues were not minor philosophical concepts to her. They were bothering her deeply and upsetting her life. It is, of course, the case that being required to do stupid, hateful things is demoralizing. Someone assigned a pointless or even counterproductive task will deflate, if they have any sense, and find within themselves very little motivation to carry out the assignment. Why? Because every fiber of their genuine being fights against that necessity. We do the things we do because we think those things important, compared to all the other things that could be important. We regard what we value as worthy of sacrifice and pursuit. That worthiness motivates us to act, despite the fact that action is difficult and dangerous. When we are called upon to do things that we find hateful and stupid, we are simultaneously forced to act contrary to the structure of values motivating us to move forward stalwartly and protecting us from dissolution into confusion and terror. "To thine own self be true," as Polonius has it in Shakespeare's Hamlet. That self, that integrated psyche, is in truth the ark that shelters us when the storms gather and the water rises. To act in violation of its precepts, its fundamental beliefs, is to run our own ship onto the shoals of destruction. To act in violation of the precepts of that fundamental self is to cheat in the game we play with ourselves, to suffer the emptiness of betrayal, and to perceive abstractly and then experience in embodied form the loss that is inevitably to come. What price did my client pay for her initial subjugation to the arbitrary dictates of her managers? She was an immigrant from a former Soviet bloc country and had experienced more than a sufficient taste of authoritarian ideology. In consequence, her inability to determine how she might object to what was happening left her feeling both weak and complicit. Furthermore, no sensible person could possibly remain motivated to put forth effort anywhere such as her workplace had become, where absurdities of a conceptual sort were not only continually occurring, but encouraged, or even worse, required. Such action makes a mockery of productive work itself, even the very idea of productive work. And that is, in fact, part of the true motivation for such behavior. Those jealous of genuine competence and productivity have every reason to undermine and denigrate even the concept of both. So, what did she do about the demoralizing state in which she found herself? My client did not feel sufficiently confident in her position or in the ability of her managers to engage in a genuine conversation about her objections, although it was clear from my conversations with her that she very much wished to escape from the situation. In consequence, she began to develop what might be considered a rear guard action. She was already involved in developing in-house education projects for the company, as we mentioned. It was possible for her, therefore, to begin to branch out, offering her services as a speaker at a variety of corporate conferences. Although she never directly confronted the flip chart issue, and may have been wise to avoid doing so, she began to speak out against the kind of pseudoscience that characterizes many of the ideas that corporate managers, particularly in human resources departments, regard as valid. She presented a number of talks, for example, criticizing the widespread fad of learning styles, a theory predicated on the idea that there are between 4 and 8 different modalities that individuals prefer and that aid them if used when they are trying to master new ideas. These include, for example, visual, auditory, verbal, physical, and logical, among others. The problem with the learning styles theory? Most basically, there's simply no evidence whatsoever for its validity. First, although students may express a preference for information being delivered in one form over another, practically delivering it in that form does not improve their academic performance. Second, and this makes sense given the first problem, there is no evidence that teachers can accurately assess the learning style of their students. So, although it was not possible for my client to directly confront the particular foolishness that was disturbing her, after long strategizing and much work, she did manage to push back very effectively against the ignorance that characterized what passed for psychological knowledge among a substantial subset of her co-workers, as well as those who worked in other companies where the same things were taking place. She had also done some work as a journalist for one of the major newspapers in Albania, her country of origin, and began to make continuing to do so a higher priority. This did not pay well, but she developed a stellar professional reputation there and fought hard in print for what she believed in, warning the citizens of her once communist-dominated state of the move toward totalitarian opinion beginning to make itself attractive to people in the West. What price did she pay for her decision to stand up and fight? To begin with, she had to face her fear of reprisal, as well as the fact that such fear, in combination with the profound distaste she felt for the ideological maneuvers characterizing her workplace, was destroying her interest in her office profession, as well as making her feel inadequate and cowardly. Then she had to broaden her professional activities. First, taking the risk of offering herself as a speaker at corporate conventions, and people are generally very loath to talk publicly. It is a common fear, often severe enough to interfere with career progression. Second, mastering the literature, enabling her to speak in a credible and informed manner. And third, presenting material that, given its critical nature, was bound to offend a reasonable proportion of those in the audience, precisely those who had accepted and who were propagating the theories that she was now discrediting. This all meant the facing of her fear, of inaction as well as action. These moves challenged her deeply, but the consequence was an expansion of personality and competence, as well as the knowledge that she was making a genuine social contribution. I believe the good people do, small though it may appear, has more to do with the good that manifests itself broadly in the world than people think, and I believe the same about evil. We are each more responsible for the state of the world than we think or would feel comfortable thinking. Without careful attention, culture itself tilts towards corruption. Tyranny grows slowly and asks us to retreat in comparatively tiny steps. But each retreat increases the possibility of the next retreat. Each betrayal of conscience, each act of silence, despite the resentment we feel when silenced, and each rationalization weakens resistance and increases the probability of the next restrictive move forward. This is particularly the case when those pushing forward delight in the power they have now acquired, and such people are always to be found. Better to stand forward, awake, when the costs are relatively low, and, perhaps, when the potential rewards have not yet vanished. Better to stand forward before the ability to do so has been irretrievably compromised. Unfortunately, people often act in spite of their conscience, even if they know it, and hell tends to arrive step by step, one betrayal after another. And it should be remembered that it is rare for people to stand up against what they know to be wrong, even when the consequences for doing so are comparatively slight. And this is something to deeply consider if you are concerned with leading a moral and careful life. If you do not object when the transgressions against your conscience are minor, why presume that you will not willfully participate when the transgressions get truly out of hand? Part of moving beyond order is knowing when you have such a reason. Part of moving beyond order is understanding that your conscience has a primary claim on your action, which supersedes your conventional social duty. If you decide to stand up and refuse a command, if you do something of which others disapprove but you firmly believe to be correct, you must be in a position to trust yourself. This means that you must have attempted to live an honest, meaningful, productive life of precisely the sort that might characterize someone else you would tend to trust. If you have acted honorably so that you are a trustworthy person, it will be your decision to refuse to comply with or to act in a manner contrary to public expectation that will help society itself maintain its footing. By doing so, you can be part of the force of truth that brings corruption and tyranny to a halt. The sovereign individual, awake and attending to his or her conscience, is the force that prevents the group, as the necessary structure guiding normative social relations, from becoming blind and deadly. I do not want to end this section on a falsely optimistic note. I know from further correspondence with my client that she shifted her employment from one large organization to another several times in the years that followed. In one case, she found a good position where it was possible to engage in productive, sensible, meaningful work. However, although successful there, she was laid off during a corporate reorganization and has since found the other company she has worked for as thoroughly possessed by the current linguistic and identity politics fads as her original place of employment. Some dragons are everywhere, and they are not easy to defeat. But her attempts to fight back, her work debunking pseudoscientific theories, her work as a journalist, helped buttress her against depression and bolster her self-regard. Fortify your position. When culture disintegrates, because it refuses to be aware of its own pathology, because the visionary hero is absent, it descends into the chaos that underlies everything. Under such conditions, the individual can dive voluntarily, as deeply as he or she dares, into the depths and rediscover the eternal principles renewing vision and life. The alternative is despair, corruption, and nihilism. Thoughtless subjugation to the false words of totalitarian utopianism, and life as a miserable, lying, and resentful slave. If you wish instead to be engaged in a great enterprise, even if you regard yourself as a mere cog, you are required not to do things you hate. You must fortify your position, regardless of its meanness and littleness, confront the organizational mendacity undermining your spirit, face the chaos that ensues, rescue your near-dead father from the depths, and live a genuine and truthful life. Otherwise, nature hides her face, society stultifies, and you remain a marionette with your strings pulled by demonic forces operating behind the scenes. And one more thing, it is your fault. No one is destined in the deterministic sense to remain a puppet. We are not helpless. Even in the rubble of the most broken-down lives, useful weapons might still be found. Likewise, even the giant most formidable in appearance may not be as omnipotent as it proclaims or appears. Allow for the possibility that you may be able to fight back, that you may be able to resist and maintain your soul, perhaps even your job. But a better job may also beckon if you can tolerate the idea of the transformation. If you are willing to conceptualize yourself as someone who could, and perhaps more importantly, should, stand fast, you may begin to perceive the weapons at your disposal. If what you are doing is causing you to lash out at others impulsively, if what you are doing is destroying your motivation to move forward, if your actions and inactions are making you contemptuous of yourself and worse of the world, if the manner in which you conduct your life is making it difficult for you to wake happily in the morning, if you are plagued by a deep sense of self-betrayal, perhaps you are choosing to ignore that still small voice, inclined as you may be to consider it something only attended to by the weak and naive. If you are at work and called upon to do what makes you contemptuous of yourself, weak and ashamed, likely to lash out at those you love, unwilling to perform productively, and sick of your life, It is possible that it is time to meditate, consider, strategize, and place yourself in a position where you are capable of saying no. Perhaps you will garner additional respect from the people you are opposing on moral grounds, even though you may still pay a high price for your actions. Perhaps they will even come to rethink their stance, if not now, then with time, as their own consciences might be plaguing them in that same still, small manner. Practicalities. Perhaps you should also be positioning yourself for a lateral move, into another job, for example, noting, as you may, this occupation is deadening my soul, and that is truly not for me. It is time to take the painstaking steps necessary to organize my CV and to engage in the difficult, demanding, and often unrewarding search for a new job. But you only have to be successful once. Maybe you can find something that pays better and is more interesting, and where you are working with people who not only fail to kill your spirit, but positively rejuvenate it. Maybe following the dictates of conscience is in fact the best possible plan that you have. At minimum, otherwise, you have to live with your sense of self-betrayal and the knowledge that you put up with what you truly could not tolerate. Nothing about that is good. I might get fired. Well, prepare now to seek out and ready yourself for another job, hopefully better. Or prepare yourself to go over your manager's head with a well-prepared and articulate argument. And do not begin by presuming that leaving your job, even involuntarily, is necessarily for the worst. I am afraid to move. Well, of course you are, but afraid compared to what? Afraid in comparison to continuing in a job where the center of your being is at stake? Where you become weaker, more contemptible, more bitter, and more prone to pressure and tyranny over the years? There are few choices in life where there is no risk on either side, and it is often necessary to contemplate the risks of staying as thoroughly as the risks of moving. I have seen many people move, sometimes after several years of strategizing, and end up in better shape psychologically and pragmatically after their time in the desert. Perhaps no one else would want me. Well, the rejection rate for new job applications is extraordinarily high. I tell my clients to assume 50-1 so their expectations are set properly. You are going to be passed over in many cases for many positions for which you are qualified. But that is rarely personal. It is instead a condition of existence, an inevitable consequence of somewhat arbitrary subjection to the ambivalent conditions of worth characterizing society. It is a consequence of the fact that CVs are easy to disseminate and difficult to process, that many jobs have unannounced internal candidates and so are just going through the motions, and that some companies keep a rolling stock of applicants in case they need to hire quickly. That is an actuarial problem, a statistical problem, a baseline problem, and not necessarily an indication that there is something specifically flawed about you. You must incorporate all that sustainingly pessimistic realism into your expectations so that you do not become unreasonably downhearted. 150 applications, carefully chosen. 3-5 interviews, thereby acquired. That could be a mission of a year or more. That is much less than a lifetime of misery and downward trajectory. But it is not nothing. You need to fortify yourself for it. Plan. And garner support from people who understand what you are up to and are realistically appraised of the difficulty and the options. Now, it may also be that you are lagging in the development of your skills and could improve your performance at work so that your chances of being hired elsewhere are heightened. But there is no loss in that. You cannot effectively pronounce no in the presence of corrupt power when your options to move are non-existent. In consequence, you have a moral obligation to place yourself in a position of comparative strength and to do then what is necessary to capitalize on that strength. You may also have to think through worst-case situations and to discuss them with those who will be affected by your decisions. But it is once again worth realizing that staying where you should not be may be the true worst-case situation, one that drags you out and kills you slowly over decades. That is not a good death, even though it is slow, and there is very little in it that does not speak of the hopelessness that makes people age quickly and long for the cessation of career, and worse, life. That is no improvement. As the old and cruel cliché has it, if you must cut off a cat's tail, do not do it half an inch at a time. You may well be in for a few painful years of belated recognition of insufficiency and required to send out 4 or 5 or 10 job applications a week, knowing full well that the majority will be rejected with less than a second look. But you need to win the lottery only once, and a few years of difficulty with hope beat an entire dejected lifetime of a degenerating and oppressed career. And let us be clear. It is not a simple matter of hating your job because it requires you to wake up too early in the morning or to drag yourself to work when it is too hot or cold or windy or dry or when you are feeling low and want to curl up in bed. It is not a matter of frustration generated when you are called upon to do things that are menial but necessary, such as emptying garbage cans, sweeping floors, cleaning bathrooms, or in any manner taking your lowly but well-deserved place at the bottom of the hierarchy of competence, even of seniority. Resentment generated by such necessary work is most often merely ingratitude, inability to accept a lowly place at the beginning, unwillingness to adopt the position of the fool, or arrogance and lack of discipline. Hearkening to the call of conscience is by no means the same thing as irritation about undesirably low status. The betrayal of soul is truly the requirement to undertake demonstrably counterproductive, absurd, or pointless work, to treat others unjustly and to lie about it, to engage in deceit and betray your future self, to put up with unnecessary torture and abuse, and to silently watch others suffer the same treatment. That betrayal is the turning of a blind eye and the agreement to say and do things that subvert your deepest values and make you a cheat at your own game. And there is no doubt that the road to hell, personally and socially, is paved not so much with good intentions as with the adoption of attitudes and undertaking of actions that inescapably disturb your conscience. Do not do what you hate.